Good evening to everyone once again. Welcome back to the assembly. We're so thankful to see all that are able to be with us for our afternoon service. We'll be continuing our series that we've been engaging in Sunday evenings of going through the Sermon on the Mount. I've enjoyed the study that I've been able to do personally on it so far. I've enjoyed the other sermons I've been able to hear. Sermon on the Mount is something that I've always referenced or used in other sermons, known about, but not something that I've specifically studied in depth before, and I feel bad about that, and I'm enjoying the study now very much, and I hope that it's proving fruitful for you as well. We'll be picking up in verse 27 tonight, and we'll be considering verses 27 through verse 32, and so for now, I'd like to just go ahead and read those few verses. Jesus says there, beginning in Matthew chapter 5 and verse 27, "You have heard that it was said to those of old, 'You shall not commit adultery.' But I say to you that whoever looks at a woman to lust for her has already committed adultery with her in his heart. If your right eye causes you to sin, pluck it out and cast it from you, for it is more profitable for you that one of your members perish than for your whole body to be cast into hell. And if your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off and cast it from you. For it is more profitable for you that one of your members perish than for your whole body to be cast into hell. Furthermore, it has been said, 'Whoever divorces his wife, let him give her a certificate of divorce.' But I say to you that whoever divorces his wife for any reason except sexual immorality causes her to commit adultery, and whoever marries a woman who is divorced commits adultery." The section that we have for our consideration from the Sermon on the Mount is a very, very important. Not that the other parts of the Sermon on the Mount are not important. They are all important. But this is really a section that gets at one of the main problems that mankind has had basically for all of time. Sexual immorality and the desires that mankind has had that have led him off into various perversions from God's will have plagued mankind. They plagued the nation of Israel. They plagued people in the early years of the church. And these are temptations that face people today. You look at our society, you look at our culture, and you see that our world and our society is steeped and engrossed in all types of sin, all types of things that go against God's pattern and God's will. And so it's important that we make sure as we are striving to be citizens of Christ's kingdom, and remember, that's what the Sermon on the Mount is all about. It is about the nature of the kingdom that Christ was establishing and has established, and it's about what the citizens of that kingdom look like. And so when it comes to purity, when it comes to how we view the immorality around us and what we tolerate or what we don't tolerate, what we allow and what we don't allow, how we live our lives, it is of utmost importance that we shape our lives not based upon culture, but upon the law of God. And that lesson about purity leads into a lesson that Jesus gives, brief as it is in this portion of Scripture, about marriage as well. Now, this is a very key text along with Matthew chapter 19, and we'll consider that for a little while this evening as well, about the whole question of divorce and remarriage. I'm just going to say from the onset tonight, I will probably not be able to answer every question you may have. The focus of this sermon is not a sermon about divorce and remarriage. The focus of this sermon is these five verses from the Sermon on the Mount, but that will be a portion of it because that's where we find ourselves. But I think if we just let the Bible speak and if we just take Jesus for what he says and study what he says and apply what he says, I think we can come away with an appropriate understanding about the situations that we sometimes have to deal with. But more importantly than answering the questions of divorce and remarriage, I think that our emphasis needs to be what Jesus' emphasis was, and this is what I'm going to try and stress tonight, and that is on what is right. So often, we get bogged down by questions of what about this, and what about that, and what about this situation, and what if this were to happen, when really the right answer, the best answer, is do it the Lord's way from the beginning. And we won't have to worry about exceptions. And we won't have to worry about what ifs. And we won't have to worry about what's okay here and what's okay there if we'll just submit ourselves to the will of the Lord from the very beginning. And so I hope that the study that we have tonight is helpful. I hope it gives you some things to think about and study on your own. I hope that if you have questions after the sermon is over, that you'll be willing to ask me, and I'd be happy to discuss them and study any of these things out further as is needed. But before we go into this study, and before we delve into these wonderful words of the Lord in this sermon, we have a wonderful opportunity, and that is to go before God in a word of prayer. So at this time, let us pray. One of the things that I've enjoyed about going through the Sermon on the Mount in more detail is gaining a much greater appreciation for the way in which the Lord builds point upon point, the way in which the sermon reflects the same thoughts throughout, the way that what Jesus says in one point will permeate in various ways throughout the remainder of the sermon. And I think that is true with what we have to discuss tonight. And so for just a very brief while, I want to look and see what we've covered so far by way of review and reminder. And we've seen what we've discussed so far as have been the foundation was the Beatitudes. Remember those opening 12 verses where Jesus laid forth those blessed are these statements, and we spent a few sermons going through those, and I want to stress that, and I want to stress for us to try and remember those and think about them as we read through and study through the rest of this sermon, because they really are the foundation. The Beatitudes are describing the character and the attitude of kingdom citizens. And if we can and will and choose to develop the attitude, the attitudes that Jesus describes in the Beatitudes, then we can live up to and fulfill the commands and the actions and the lifestyles that you find throughout the rest of the sermon. And we'll even see some of the way that a couple of the Beatitudes, and one in particular, play a very important role in what we have to discuss this evening. So Jesus laid the groundwork with the attitudes and the character of a citizen of his kingdom. But he went on from there to then discuss the fact that while citizens of the kingdom will be persecuted, that was the final beatitude, blessed are those are you when you are persecuted. He said that the way that we respond to the persecution of the world is actually by influencing the world. And that is there in verses 13 through 16 where Jesus taught that his followers, his disciples, his citizens should be the salt and the light of the world. Now, to be the salt and the light of the world, we need to be very different from the world. And so when we get to the lesson like we have tonight, where we're going to discuss purity and fidelity, we need to realize that we need to be different than the world. If we wish to impact the world, if we wish to be the salt of the earth, and if we wish to be the light of the world, then our lives, from a moral standpoint, should look different than the lives of those around us. Our view of marriage should look radically different than that of many of the people around us. Why? Because we follow God's law and we hold it very dear and we take it very seriously. But then Jesus would go on to discuss his fulfillment of the law, the fact that he was not abolishing the law, but he was fulfilling it. That means that the old was coming to an end. That's what it means to be fulfilled, and he is bringing in the new covenant. And from there, he goes on to begin a section about righteousness, about what righteous behavior looks like. He's talked about attitudes. Now he's going to talk about behavior. And the last thing that we looked at was murder and hatred and anger there in verses 21 through 26. That began a section where Jesus has several points where he says, you have heard it said, but I say unto you. And there's a couple of things that I think are taking place. One, he is building further upon what has already been shown. He is superseding the law of Moses. When he says, but I say unto you, he is speaking authoritatively. And thus, he is showing that he is giving new law. We don't live under the old law. We don't live under the Old Testament. We live under the, but I say unto you, of the New Testament. And so Jesus is laying forth his new law, but he's also correcting some of the problems that had come up over the years, and he's showing where they were wrong and mistaken. He is preparing them to be true citizens of the kingdom. And one of the problems that some of the Jews had is they had become very ritualistic, the Pharisees and the scribes in particular. And so Jesus shows that under his law, under the new law, there is much more than just going through the actions. He starts with murder. They all knew that murder was wrong. But he wanted them to see that citizens of the kingdom didn't harbor hatred either. And they didn't speak evil of others either. And they weren't angry without cause or unjustly. And Jesus actually equates these things to basically murder of the heart. Oh, we might not take someone's life. But when we hate, and when we're unjustly angered, and when we speak ill of people, we're held just as guilty in the sight of God. Well, we come to the next section of this portion of the Lord's sermon where he talks about righteous behavior. And now he moves on from anger and hatred, and he moves on to purity. And from purity into the realm of marriage and the question of divorce. The way we're going to go through this tonight is through three sections. You know, this little part, there's two verses in each of these that make for a good outline. So we'll discuss the real purity that Jesus discusses in verses 27 through 28, how we obtain that purity by mortifying the flesh or mortifying sinful nature, or our desire to sin in verses 29 through 30, and then that leads into the discussion of purity in marriage in verses 31 and 32. So let's just jump right in now to Matthew chapter 5. Let's reread verses 27 through 28. Jesus says, "You have heard that it was said to those of old, 'You shall not commit adultery.' But I say to you that whoever looks at a woman to lust for her has already committed adultery with her in his heart." Now, Jesus quotes here from the old law, and this is a direct quotation at this point from the Ten Commandments in Exodus 20 and verse 14, and then also when this was re-given in Deuteronomy 5 verse 18. Those are the exact passages. "You shall not commit adultery." And so Jesus reaffirms that adultery is clearly a sin. But as we discuss adultery, something that we need to realize, this is true under the old law, and it's true under the new covenant. Jesus is speaking about gratification of sexual desires outside of God's designs and God's plan. Sex is not something that is evil and that is wrong. Hebrews 13 verse 4 says, "Marriage is honorable among all and the bed undefiled, but fornicators and adulterers God will judge." Sex is a part of God's creation. It's something that God gave to mankind. But it becomes sinful when man seeks to fulfill sexual desires outside of God's plan. Anything that falls outside of the purview of how God has deemed it appropriate for man to fulfill his desires is sinful. And in moral standards, in moral cases, anything outside of the marriage relationship, I might add, as defined by God, any fulfillment outside of that is sinful and becomes evil. Now, our society worships, in many ways, sexual gratification. It is the center of many people's lives. That's why you can't tell people what to do and what not to do. It's what's led to the movements that we've seen over the past years. And that's not something new. That's been taking place since the sexual revolution of the 60s. And people have just pushed it further and further and further. The problem is not sex itself, but define or trying to gratify the flesh outside of the parameters that God has set. Now, that's always been true. Under the Old Testament, God had laws around how to fulfill those desires, and those in the Old Testament were always within the bounds of marriage, fornication, homosexuality, adultery. All of those sins were sins under the Old Testament. In fact, they were very grievous sins under the Old Testament. They were sins that brought about the death penalty. But Jesus, as he expounds upon this, shows that adultery, immorality, sexual sin is actually more than just a physical activity. Remember the prohibition of murder that Jesus has talked about. He talked about murder, but murder was sort of an umbrella. Obviously, actual murder, taking of someone's life, is wrong. But Jesus placed this hatred and unjust anger and speaking evil or insulting others in a hateful way under the category of murder. Now, we don't think that way sometimes. We think, well, I can insult a person, but that's not nearly as bad as murder, right? Well, on a certain level, true. But in the eyes of God, it's still sinful. And we still stand condemned when we're unjustly angry or when we're hateful or when we speak ill towards others, even if we don't kill them in action. We kill them in words or we kill them in mind. It's a murder of the heart. Well, Jesus is making a similar point with the act of adultery. Not only is the actual act of adultery sinful, but so too is lust. So too is looking upon someone with that evil desire. So too are the fantasies that people allow themselves to engage in, even if they say to themselves that they would never actually partake in the sin itself. Jesus is teaching that these things are sinful, and he calls them adultery in the heart. Now, because Jesus is applying this to the heart, this should immediately make us remember a certain beatitude. He says that whoever looks upon a woman to lust for her has already committed adultery with her in his heart. Remember the sixth beatitude in Matthew 5 verse 8, Jesus said, "Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God." Remember that beatitude and the importance that purity is not just abstaining from certain actions. And God's law and God's kingdom for the new covenant is not just about getting people to act a certain way, but converting and transforming our very hearts and minds and motivations. It is not enough to just abstain from adultery. It is not enough to just abstain from fornication. Some people think that they can gratify their desires in other ways as long as they don't go through with the deed. But Jesus is showing that true spirituality gets all the way down to the heart. It gets down to the mind and to the motives. And if we really seek purity, if we really want to be pure, if we really want to be pleasing to the Father, we must transform not just our actions, but also our minds. Later on in Matthew 15 and 19, Jesus would say, "For out of the heart proceed evil thoughts and murders and adulteries and fornications and thefts, false witnesses and blasphemies." Where do these things come from? They come from the heart. You see, that's the problem. Sometimes whenever someone looks upon sin as long as I don't act this way or do this thing, but they allow the fantasy, and whether that's sexual immorality or drug use or murder or anything else, whatever sin it might be, when we allow ourselves to even contemplate it, to think about it, to dwell upon it, we're just setting the stage. You know, people don't just commit adultery out of the blue. People don't just have a wonderful marriage and then one day, all of a sudden, the perfect situation arises and they cheat on their spouse. That action is always precipitated by an impure heart, by a heart that has allowed that possibility to even exist. And we need to take warning. If we allow impure thoughts to take root in our heart, maybe today we think we would never do something that terrible. Maybe today we think, "Oh, well, I would never actually act upon that." Maybe not today, but maybe down the road we would. Because if we allow that to fester in our heart, then our heart is not pure. And if the heart's not pure, then at some point, the actions won't be pure either. For it's out of the heart that all of these things come. Now, we need to be transformed. Remember what Paul said in Romans 12 and 2, "Do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind." That's what God, that's what Christ's law is doing, is it's not just laying out a bunch of rules for us to check off a list. It is literally transforming the way we think, and thus also the way that we live. So if we wish to be pure, we must be pure in heart. But notice something. Jesus makes a very clear connection between the heart and the eyes. And this is something that we can't miss. If we wish to be pure in heart, then we need to be careful about what we put in front of our eyes. Now, if you want an example of how timeless and also timely God's word is, this is a verse right here. Jesus was not speaking to people that could go home and turn on their television. Jesus was not speaking to people that had access to the World Wide Web. Jesus was not speaking to people that carried around a device in their pockets that they could get on and look at anything they could possibly imagine. And even to them, Jesus said, "You guard your eyes." how much more applicable is that to us today in the 21st century who have access to literally anything that we put our minds to? How important is it for us to be very, very careful, to be cautious about what we read, what we look at, what we watch, what we listen to, what we entertain ourselves by on our cell phones? If we wish to be pure in action, we must be pure in heart. And if we wish to be pure in heart, we must be careful about what we put in front of our eyes. Now, later on in chapter 6, Jesus is going to say that the eye is the lamp of the body, and if the eye is full of darkness, the body will be full of darkness. He's saying, if what you put before your eyes is evil and sinful, don't be surprised if before long you're evil and sinful. Maybe you can hide it for a while. But the more you watch and the more you see and the more that you allow things of this world to influence you by watching them and being entertained by them, the more dangerous it is for you, the harder it is for you to become and stay pure of heart. Go back to Job with me for a little bit. Job chapter 31, Job is speaking through verses 1 through 9, but let's look at this progression. Job says, I have made a covenant with my eyes. Why then should I look upon a young woman? Job made the active choice. Job had temptations, just as every human being does. But Job knew temptation. And Job made an active choice. He said, I have made a covenant with my eyes, but I will not look upon a young woman. What's he talking about? Does he mean that he never notices when another person is attractive? Does he mean that he never even looks the way of another person? No, he's saying that he will not allow himself to look longingly upon another. He will not allow himself to lust over another individual. It's not okay for him to just look but not touch. Have you ever heard people say that? Have you ever said that? I've heard people say, trying to joke about it, you know, married men say, well, you might be on a diet, but it doesn't hurt to look at the menu. Well, that might get a chuckle out of some people, but that's wrong. Because it's not just the act that's sinful, it's the lusting that's sinful. And thus Job said, I've made a covenant with my eyes. I've made an agreement with myself that I will not look. I will not lust. Go on to verse 7. He says, if my step has turned from the way, or my heart walked after my eyes, or if any spot adheres to my hands. Goes on to say that he deserves punishment. Notice that. If my heart has walked after my eyes, we can tell ourselves all that we want to that we're not influenced by the world. And I'm not here to legislate and to say what you can and you can't do specifically, or what you can and can't watch or listen to. But I'm going to say, be careful. And I think we all can make good choices. And we need to understand that after a while, our hearts will follow our eyes. And if we allow ourselves to be entertained by the filth of the world for very long, then our hearts will follow at some point. And if our hearts follow, the actions will follow at some point as well. But then also verse 9, if my heart has been enticed by a woman, or if I have lurked at my neighbor's door. Notice now he's connecting the heart with the woman. Where did he start? He started with his eyes and a young woman, and now it's his heart, and he's actually lurking at the neighbor's door. Job got it. I think we do too. The longer we allow ourselves to be entertained by sin, the more it influences us, the less we're influencing the world at that point. It's influencing us. And the closer we are to acting upon the sin. Jesus says, don't even start. Jesus says, even the lust, even the longing look is sinful. It might not be physical adultery, but it is adultery of the heart. We need to be very careful about what we watch, how we think, where we allow our minds to go, if we truly wish to be pure. If we want to be pure in heart, we must choose to remove the source of temptation as much as is possible. Which leads us to the next portion of what Jesus says, verses 29 through 30. He says, if your right eye causes you to sin, pluck it out and cast it from you. For it is more profitable for you than that one of your members perish than for your whole body to be cast into hell. And if your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off and cast it from you. For it is more profitable for you that one of your members perish than your whole body to be cast into hell. Jesus here answers, how is it that you can keep your eyes pure? You remove the source. I'll get to this in just a minute. He's not speaking literally that we all need to pluck our eyes out. What Jesus is saying is, one, he's using hyperbole here because he wants to stress the seriousness of sin. And he's especially stressing the seriousness of sexual immorality, of adultery, fornication, and sexual sin. And he's teaching us to remove the source. He's saying, don't look. Don't touch. And remove whatever you have to remove from your life so that the temptation isn't there. Now, Jesus is not literally commending people to mutilate themselves. There have been people throughout history who have taken this so far that they have literally mutilated themselves in various ways. And that's not what Jesus is teaching. I think we can see that because Jesus uses this again in Matthew chapter 18, just talking about sin in general. He says, if your hand or foot causes you to sin, or if your eye causes you to sin. But notice he says, it is better for you to enter into life lame or maimed rather than having two hands or two feet to be cast into the everlasting fire. Jesus uses a little bit different there. In the Sermon on the Mount, he doesn't even talk about life. He just talks about it's better not to be cast into hell with the whole body. But here he says it's better to enter into life lame. Well, that teaches us, that shows us that Jesus is not speaking completely literally. Because we know that, you know, you don't go to heaven if you lose a foot here. That doesn't mean that you're robbed of that foot in heaven, that you're lame throughout all of eternity. So Jesus isn't teaching literally to cut off our hands and our feet or to literally pluck out our eyes. He's saying you remove the source. You remove whatever you need to in order to make sure that you don't sin. John Stott put it this way in his commentary. He said, Jesus is not advocating a literal physical self-maiming, but ruthless moral self-denial, not mutilation, but mortification. I like the way he puts that. And that's biblical language. Now, this is the New King James Version. In the King James Version, this phrase put to death is that word mortify. But Romans 8:13, if you live according to the flesh, you will die. But if by the Spirit you put to death or mortify the deeds of the body, you will live. Colossians 3:5, therefore put to death or mortify your members which are on the earth, fornication, uncleanness, passion, evil desire, and covetousness, which is idolatry. The message of the cross, the message of this kingdom of God's, or the citizen of God's kingdom, is we mortify our physical desires that lead us to sin. We only fulfill them within the bonds of God's law. And anything that moves us to go past God's law, we get rid of. This is showing how serious sin is. It means that sometimes we need to make some sacrifices and we need to make some choices so that we make sure we live right for God. This can apply in a lot of ways other than just immoral sin. You know, this might sound crazy in 2016, but if you can't control yourself on a cellular device that gives you open access to everything you can possibly look at, get a dumb phone instead of a smartphone, or get rid of the phone altogether. It might be worth not getting texts. It might be worth having to call people back because they left a message on your landline than to be in sin. It sounds ridiculous, doesn't it? Almost like cutting off your hand. But get rid of it. Wouldn't it be better to get to heaven and go through life without a smartphone than to go to hell because you had a temptation in front of you all the time? I'm not saying it's sinful to have a cell phone. I have a smartphone. But if you can't control it, get rid of it. I don't think it's sinful to have a television in your home. But if you can't control what you watch and you allow it to influence you and you can't control, get rid of it. Get rid of the source of the sin. If your job won't allow you to worship the Lord, get a new job. If people at your job influence you past what you can control and bear, get a new job. Whatever it is in your life, if it is going to cause you to sin, get rid of it. Because there's nothing in this life that is worth your soul. That's a serious lesson that Jesus is teaching. And it might sound drastic, because it is. But then again, him coming all the way from heaven to die on a cross was a pretty drastic measure too, wasn't it? So what should we be willing to do and give up so that we might be pure in heart and pure in deed? We need to mortify the flesh. And as we think about purity, and as we think about being pure in heart, and especially when we think about sexual sin and being pure morally, that leads into God's design, which of course is marriage. And so Jesus speaks about this. Now, marriage is a beautiful and a wonderful thing. It's the first institution that God gave to us. It's the first institution for the well-being of man that God created, was a marriage between a man and a wife. One of the first things that you see in the book of Genesis is the degradation of the family. It's not too many generations before you see a man named Lamech, who it says had two wives. That was a departure from the pattern. And it only went further south from there. Today, when we look at society around us, we see a departure from the pattern. You know, we look around today at society and we see the movements that have taken place. We see the laws that have been passed. And we wonder, how did we get here? People say, I just can't believe where we've come. I just can't believe what is going on now. It actually started here 100 years ago when marriage itself was decided that it's not all that it should be. I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself. But people, when they started deciding that divorce and remarriage wasn't a big deal, not just the world, but religious people, started viewing marriage as something that could be thrown away and re-jumped into, that's what started us on the path to where we are today. It just shocks us a lot more today with what we see. But it started a long time ago when man started departing from God's pattern. But listen to what Jesus says as he talks about marriage. He says, furthermore, it has been said, whoever divorces his wife, let him give her a certificate of divorce. But I say to you, that whoever divorces his wife for any reason except sexual immorality causes her to commit adultery, and whoever marries a woman who is divorced commits adultery. Now, Jesus is this, for whoever divorces his wife, let him give her a certificate of divorce. This is from Deuteronomy chapter 24, verses 1 through 4. Now, this is a part of the law, but this is a part of the law that was highly debated amongst the Jews and had been misinterpreted by many of the Jews. Let's just read this very quickly. It says there, when a man takes a wife and marries her, and it happens that she finds no favor in his eyes because he has found some uncleanness in her, and he writes her a certificate of divorce, puts it in her hand, and sends her out of his house. When she is departed from his house and goes and becomes another man's wife, if the latter husband detests her and writes her a certificate of divorce, puts it in her hand, and sends her out of his house, or if the latter husband dies who took her as his wife, then her former husband who divorced her must not take her back to be his wife after she has been defiled. For that is an abomination before the Lord, and you shall not bring sin on the land which the Lord your God has given you as an inheritance. This was the primary proof passage that many of the Jewish leaders used to justify their divorce. Now, it's clear when you look at history that divorce was quite rampant in some ways, even amongst the Jewish culture. From what I've read, some of the rabbis debated this hotly, and you had two different sides of the issue. You had one rabbi who believed that this was almost like what the New Testament teaches, that this had to be a very specific sin and was very stringent on the way that divorce could be carried out. But other rabbis, and this seemed to become the popular opinion, thought that this uncleanness could basically be anything. In fact, there's rabbis that taught that if a wife miscooked a meal and it upset the husband, that was enough of a reason for her to be detestable in his sight and him to send her on the way. If as they got older, she just wasn't pretty enough anymore, that was an uncleanness worthy of divorce. And they would send her on the way and go get another wife. Well, that clearly wasn't what Moses had allowed in the law. That was a gross misinterpretation of the law. We're going to get to Matthew 19 here in just a moment. But there's something important about Deuteronomy 24 that we have to see. This is different than what Jesus is teaching. Because some people try and say Jesus is just teaching the same thing as Deuteronomy 24, and he's not. Because there is an uncleanness. Now, there's a lot of debate about what this uncleanness was. But some people automatically assume that this uncleanness was some type of sexual impurity. But I don't think it could have been that. Because as you go through the law, every type of sexual impurity, whether it was fornication before marriage or whether it was adultery after marriage, that brought about the death penalty. That didn't bring about divorce. That brought about stoning. And so if a man discovered that his wife was unfaithful, he didn't give her a certificate of divorce. They stoned her. And vice versa. So that's not what Deuteronomy was teaching. And the real thrust of Deuteronomy 24 is actually this last verse. What God is specifically condemning is men that would put away their wives, and then she would marry another husband, and then whether that husband died or he put her away, then the former husband regretted his decision, and he goes back and he remarries her again. And God says that's an abomination. That's the real thrust of Deuteronomy chapter 24. But now Jesus builds his law. Jesus sets forth his law about marriage and divorce, and he says, I say to you, this is the authoritative word of Jesus, anyone who puts his wife away for any cause other than adultery, listen to this, causes her to commit adultery. Jesus assumed something, that a wife that had been put away would remarry. And that makes sense back then. Men were the primary earners. It was disdainful to be put away. It was secure to be married. And so a woman put away would seek another relationship and another marriage. And Jesus says, when you do this, that relationship that she enters into is going to be adulterous. And anybody that marries a person that is divorced is committing adultery. It's pretty clear what Jesus is saying. When you divorce for any reason other than sexual immorality, any sexual relationship that takes place, even in marriage after that, is adultery. Now, people come up with all sorts of reasons. And I realize, you know, this is not a sermon on marriage. So we can't get into all of this. But I've talked with people that are in pretty big messes. Their relationships sometimes are terrible. And they're not treated well, and they don't treat each other well, and they just want out. They can't stand each other. But Jesus says, gives one exception. He says, except for the case of adultery. Now, I'm not saying it's okay to mistreat a spouse. I'm not saying it's okay to beat a spouse. I'm not saying any of that. That's wrong. But this is how serious marriage is. For those that are unmarried, this is how serious you should think about when you start looking for a spouse. Those of us that are married, this shows how committed we ought to be. This is not something we get in and we get out of. Realize the only other reason that a person is freed from their marriage is death. Ever stopped and thought about that? That's how serious adultery is. It brings about the same result as death. That's how serious marriage is. It is God's design. To help us with this and to help clarify, I want to look over at Matthew chapter 19, where Jesus teaches almost the same thing, but it's a little bit different. Because in Matthew chapter 5, Jesus is talking to the disciples. He's talking to those that are following him. In Matthew chapter 19, Jesus is answering a question. We'll look at that, verses 3 through 9. The Pharisees also came to him, testing him, and saying, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for just any reason? Notice, they were looking for any reason at all. And he answered and said to them, have you not read that he who made them at the beginning made them male and female? And said, for this reason a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. So then they are no longer two, but one flesh. Therefore what God has joined together, let not man separate. They said to him, why then did Moses command to give a certificate of divorce and to put her away? He said to them, Moses, because of the hardness of your hearts, permitted you to divorce your wives, but from the beginning it was not so. And I say to you, whoever divorces his wife, except for sexual immorality, and marries another, commits adultery, and whoever marries her who is divorced commits adultery. This passage helps us clarify a little further what Jesus is saying in Matthew chapter 5. Notice what is taking place in Matthew chapter 19. First of all, the Pharisees focused on divorce. Jesus focused on marriage. What was their question? Their question wasn't, Lord, how can we make our marriages better? Lord, how should we revere marriage? They said, can we get a divorce for any reason? What was their driving passion? The ability to get a divorce. Sometimes even good-intentioned conversations, I think, are led the wrong way because we get so preoccupied with when it's okay to get a divorce and whether or not we have the right to remarry. I've seen this in the church. I've seen respected people give advice basically to make sure that a person ensures their ability to get remarried after their divorce. And that's the first conclusion we come to. And that's not right. That's a Pharisaic mindset. Listen to this quote by Mr. Stein. He said, to be preoccupied with the grounds for divorce is to be guilty of the very Phariseeism which Jesus condemned. His whole emphasis in debating with the rabbis was positive, namely on God's original institution of marriage as an exclusive and permanent relationship. How did Jesus respond to the question about divorce? He didn't respond. He talked about marriage. They said, can we get divorced for any reason? He said, in the beginning, God created marriage. And he created it to be one man and one wife, and it was something that was exclusive, and it was permanent. What God has joined together, let not man separate. That's Jesus' answer to divorce. God designed marriage to be exclusive, and he designed it to be permanent. And when we think about marriage, whether we're getting ready for marriage or whether we're in marriage, that's how we as citizens of God's kingdom should look at it. It is exclusive and it is permanent. And we do everything in our power to make sure that it stays that way. By being pure ourselves and helping our partners be pure and fulfilling our God-given roles. That's how Jesus responded to the question about divorce. But also the Pharisees saw Moses' words as a command. They said, when Jesus answered them, they said, well, then why did Moses command to give a certificate of divorce? Because it wasn't a command. And Jesus corrects them. He says, he permitted it. Deuteronomy chapter 24 was a concession, not a command. They took it to go do whatever they wanted to. And Jesus said, it's because your forefathers and you too had such hard hearts that it was allowed. But it wasn't God's intention from the beginning. What predates the law of Moses? Creation. And from creation, the design and the plan of God has been one man for one woman for life, separated only by death. What does Jesus reinstitute in his kingdom? He doesn't allow the concession of putting away the wife. He focuses on the fact that it is to be one man for one woman for life. Exclusive and permanent. And that should be the driving focus of a marriage. The Pharisees took divorce very lightly, but Jesus took it very, very seriously. And so should we. And so what is the answer to the divorce and remarriage question? This might be a little bit simple, and it might not be the answer we always want. I think the answer to the divorce and remarriage question is to respect the sacred, God-designed institution of marriage, to build better marriages, and to build our marriages around God and around His Word. We spend so much time and effort trying to explain every situation and trying to figure out when it's okay to get a divorce and when it's okay to remarry. I think we'd be much better served by focusing on God's Word and committing ourselves to obeying it, and committing ourselves to marrying godly people, and committing ourselves to being godly spouses, and committing ourselves to love and to trust the Word of God, and build the homes that God desires us to build. We dedicate ourselves to fidelity, and to purity, and to a fulfillment of the role as God designed it to be in marriage for each of us. I sincerely believe that we won't have the question nearly as often as we do. Is it okay to divorce and to remarry? I really believe that because that's God's way. If we'll focus more on the right, we won't encounter the wrong nearly as much. So dedicate yourself and your marriage to your future spouse, to purity and fidelity. Another lesson that I want to say very quickly, I'm running out of time. Pursue reconciliation. This is a difficult one. This is a challenging one. You know, remember the Beatitudes. That's the foundation, remember? What did the Beatitudes teach? The Beatitudes taught that we are to be poor in spirit. The Beatitudes taught that we are to be meek, that we are to be peaceful and peacemakers, merciful and peacemakers. If our marriages are defined by attitudes that are poor in spirit and meek and merciful and peacemakers, how often do you think those marriages will end in divorce? When spouses display those types of attitudes. And even when a spouse does something wrong and sins, that does not absolve the other party from their responsibility to be poor in spirit, to be meek, to be peaceful, merciful, and to be peacemakers. Now, notice before this, what did Jesus speak about? He spoke about anger and hatred and then purity. What causes more anger and hatred than anything else? I'd say the worst displays of hatred and anger I've ever seen have been between people in a terrible marriage or people that have separated. And we understand why. We understand when someone sins. We understand when someone breaks our confidence and breaks our trust. How terrible that is. I'm not justifying sin. I'm trying to focus on this part. It's not justifiable. It's not excusable for us to not fulfill our roles, and it's never excusable to commit adultery. We've seen how terrible adultery is. You know, it does bother me sometimes that we are so ready to be prepared to get rid of the spouse when they commit sin. I hope I never have to experience it. I'm thankful I'm not talking from experience. But I want you to think about this. Over and over in the Old Testament, Israel's sin is compared to sexual immorality. Their idolatry is called adultery. And what did God do over and over? He sought to bring them back. He sought reconciliation. So much so that he finally sent his son to die on a cross to establish his kingdom. When I hear people say, or when we get to the point that we say, I can't forgive them, now we're on dangerous ground. Because what right will we have to go before the Father on the day of judgment and hope for forgiveness when we haven't forgiven? Blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. It might be hard. It might be difficult. It might be the hardest thing we would ever have to do. But I hope and pray that we love marriage so much, that we love God's word so much, that we love our spouse so much, that even in the toughest and most difficult of circumstances, our desire is what's right. Not just for us, but for them. And we go out of our way to make sure we can reconcile. I read from that Mr. Stott. He said that after years of pastoral ministry, he made a decision that when people would come to him and ask him about divorce, he wouldn't talk about it. He said he refused to talk with people about divorce until first they talked about marriage and reconciliation. And he said, more times than not, when they really sat down and talked about marriage and reconciliation, divorce didn't need to be talked about. And in the rare occasions that it did, it finally set the perspective to be able to follow God's law and God's permission. That's a denominational guy who has a better concept than we do sometimes, who rush towards divorce. I hope we don't do that. I hope we love God's law, and I hope that we seek purity and fidelity, but also reconciliation when the time comes. But now, when that is impossible, and there are cases where a guilty party continues in their adultery, and they refuse to reconcile, and they refuse to make things right, and the Lord at that point gives permission for a divorce, and for that innocent party to be free to remarry without committing adultery. But the focus of the Lord's lesson is not on the exception. And I'll defend the exception. I'm not trying to write it away. I'm saying the focus of the Lord is on the positive of marriage. And the focus of us, of ours, should be on the positive of marriage as well. I want to close with this quote. There is a sanctity given to marriage which human legislation ought not to violate. Let us not be among those who take up novel ideas of wedlock and seek to deform the marriage laws under the pretense of reforming them. Our Lord knows better than our modern social reformers. We had better let the laws of God alone, for we shall never discover any better. That sounds quite fitting for our day and age, I think. Do you know when this was written? This was written by Charles Spurgeon in the 1890s. In his commentary, he says that some of our states have adopted talking about their divorce laws. This is what he was talking about, divorce. He was writing a time when divorce wasn't even allowed for just any reason by every state, but a few had started it. And all the way back then, he saw that there is a sanctity given to marriage, and how well we would be, how wise we would be to heed these same words and understand the sanctity, the sacredness of that divine institution of marriage. We can't control what our country's going to do, but we can control what we're going to do and how we're going to act and how we're going to fulfill our roles and our obligations in our marriage vows. Bring the sermon to a close, and I hope that it's been helpful. I hope that it's not been confusing. I hope that it's given us some things to think about in these realms. But I hope that it has stressed the need for purity. I hope that I've stressed the need of fidelity and of devoting ourselves as much as we can possibly and even more to fulfilling God's laws. Sin is a deadly thing and it's a dangerous thing and it's not to be trifled with. So stay away from it and be pure. The culture will do what the culture will do, but remember, Jesus' sermon is calling us to be different. So let's be different. Let's be pure. Let's be moral. Let's show the world what real marriage looks like by being the husbands and the wives that we ought to be. And then a lot of these other questions that come up will probably take care of themselves.